In my earliest days as a newbie therapist, while I was still in graduate school, I discovered that no matter what issues brought people into treatment, 9 out of 10 times there was some kind of trauma beneath the surface. And I made a commitment early on to learn everything I could about treating trauma.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, the Executive Director, and today we're discussing an important method for healing trauma with the use of a therapy called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. We're constantly reminded that we're confronting a mental health crisis in America, especially with regard to our youth. Society seems beset by mass shootings and acts of violence daily, which compound the large-scale trauma already inflicted by the pandemic. Well, EMDR seems to offer hope to many trauma sufferers, and it has been garnering great interest for its and credibility as an efficient and effective treatment option. EMDR was discovered in 1987 by psychologist Francine Shapiro, who found a novel method for getting people's thinking brains to work together with their emotional brains to resolve symptoms of trauma. Since then, it has provided healing to countless sufferers of PTSD and other stress-related problems, ranging from depression, chronic pain, anxiety, and addiction. What's more, it appears to be able to fast-track healing in a limited number of sessions, which makes it more cost-effective and within reach for countless trauma sufferers. We have with us an internationally renowned expert in EMDR, Dr. Debbie Korn, who has a private practice in Cambridge, Mass, and who has co-authored a new book on the subject. She's joined by Michael Baldwin, her co-author and a communications professional in New York. And I ought to tell you the name of the book is Every Memory Deserves Respect. Okay, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
First, let's start with you, Debbie. As a therapist, how did you come into this area of expertise in your career? And why were you so impressed with the efficacy and broad application of this method?
Well, in my earliest days as a newbie therapist, while I was still in graduate school, I discovered that no matter what issues brought people into treatment, 9 out of 10 times there was some kind of trauma beneath the surface. And I made a commitment early on to learn everything I could about treating trauma. But the field of trauma-informed treatment was still in its infancy at that time. I worked with combat veterans, with rape survivors, families of murder victims, men and women who'd experienced significant childhood abuse and neglect. And then in the summer of 1991, I traveled back to Denver, Colorado, where I had gone to graduate school to visit my graduate school mentor, Andy Sweet. And I was telling Andy how frustrated I was feeling with the limitations of the treatment models available to me when treating chronic trauma survivors. You know, in my mind, teaching patients kind of a raft of cognitive or behavioral coping skills and helping them to manage symptoms seemed necessary, but not sufficient. And more traditional talk therapy models lacked the focus and the clear path to healing that I was looking for. I was discouraged by the idea put forth in many of these models that treatment needed to be long-term, sometimes very long-term, to be effective. And I was looking for something that paid more attention to the body, to the ways that trauma remained locked in the nervous system. And my mentor, Andy, said to me, there's this new therapy called EMDR. It's quite unique. It sounds kind of wacky, but I'm getting remarkable results and you have to go get trained in it. So I ran and I got trained with Francine Shapiro, the developer of EMDR, later that year. And about a year after that, I joined the faculty of Dr. Shapiro's EMDR Institute and started teaching EMDR and consulting to other therapists nationally and internationally. And kind of the rest is history, but I was drawn to EMDR because I wanted something that was effective and efficient and tolerable for patients. I wanted something that was dependable and precise. I wanted something that didn't necessarily require patients to recount the details of their traumatic experiences over and over again. And I loved that EMDR attended to emotions, the body, and people's belief systems. And then it seemed to tap into people's innate healing mechanisms, their innate healing system. And as you said, I quickly discovered that EMDR could be used with many different problems, not just PTSD for which it was originally developed. No matter what symptoms people presented with, we could trace the origin of these symptoms back to earlier traumatic or adverse experiences in their life, and we could get to work. But mostly though, I was drawn to EMDR because it seemed to work better and faster than anything that I had used previously.
So we know all about PTSD. It gets a lot more publicity than perhaps other forms of trauma, but let's define, if you would, for us, what trauma is, and there's different types, you know, small and large. So perhaps you could tell us.
Sure. Trauma is a part of life. 70% of adults have experienced at least one significant trauma. Probably only 20% of that 70% wind up having PTSD, being diagnosed with PTSD, but 70% have experienced trauma. In our book, we define trauma as any experience that feels overwhelming, triggers strong negative emotions like shame or terror, and involves a sense of powerlessness or intense vulnerability. And I always like to say that trauma is both objective and subjective. It's both the event and the experience of the event. So no two people exposed to the same trauma are going to have the same response to that event. So it's not just what happened to you, but also what happens inside of you. We also know that the greater the number of traumas that someone is exposed to, the greater the psychological, the physical toll. We know that trauma is cumulative and it's developmentally bound, which means that when you're exposed to trauma as a younger person, as a child or an infant, you're less equipped to deal with that trauma and you're more likely to experience the impact of that trauma in more profound ways. And when we talk about trauma, we talk about big T and little T trauma. Big T traumas are the events that most anyone would consider traumatic, what we might call shock traumas, where the person perceives a potential threat to their survival or the survival of loved ones. So here we're talking about childhood sexual, physical, or emotional abuse, rape or physical assault, the traumatic death or murder of a loved one, combat-related trauma, devastation related to an environmental disaster, witnessing violence. When we talk about little t, we're talking about the experiences that people might not necessarily recognize as traumatic, or events that might not necessarily meet the official criteria for a so-called trauma, like the way trauma is defined in our diagnostic manuals. So here we're talking about criticism, covert bullying, experiences of betrayal, experiences involving humiliation or failure or aloneness, subtle microaggressions, as well as blatant discrimination or hostility related to race or ethnicity or gender or sexual orientation. You know, examples of little t traumas in adulthood might be a divorce or losing a job or a difficult move or the discovery of a partner's affair. Examples in childhood might be feeling ignored or feeling different, unable to measure up, or powerless to control the craziness or the chaos in your family. And then finally, the last thing I'd want to say as we try to define trauma and the different types of trauma is that trauma involves both omission and commission. When we talk about acts of commission, we're referring to the things that happen to you, right? The assault, the emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, the car accident, the traumatic loss. When we talk about omission, we're referring to situations where things were supposed to happen, but didn't. Situations where someone was not properly protected, properly listened to, cared for, or valued. So here we're talking about experience of neglect, of deprivation, abandonment, alienation, invisibility. So it's really important to remember that it's not just the obvious forms of trauma, but it's these kind of invisible forms of trauma or these absences as well.
So before we actually talk about this technique itself, why is it important to treat trauma and can we heal from it like we heal from a bodily injury?
Well, you know, when people don't address the traumas being held in their nervous system, there can be significant psychological and physical toll. Unresolved trauma can manifest as PTSD or complex PTSD, depression or anxiety, unresolved trauma can lead people to live in fear, to avoid places and people and things, to turn away from opportunities or relationships that could potentially enrich their lives. When people don't recognize and address the trauma in their past or their current lives, they often wind up feeling not good enough, powerless, trapped. But the good news is that we can heal from trauma. The theory behind EMDR argues that the mind can heal from trauma in the same way the body heals from physical trauma. We're all physiologically geared toward the achievement of optimal health.
Well, that's good news for everyone. There's hope. There's hope in sight. We don't want to depress you all. We all know we live in a very traumatic time in world history, everything really. So let's now talk about this particular process. Again, for people coming in, we're talking today about EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And it's a method of treating trauma. So if I was a fly on the wall, Debbie, in one of your sessions, what might I expect to happen?
So first, let me just say that eye movement desensitization reprocessing. Desensitization refers to the reduction of distress or fear or anxiety. Reprocessing is kind of the reevaluation or the restructuring of thoughts and beliefs and the transformation of one's sense of self relative to the trauma. And the eye movement part, Francine Shapiro, the developer of EMDR, accidentally discovered that purposely moving your eyes horizontally back and forth while focusing on a traumatic memory leads to a reduction in the vividness and the emotional intensity of the memory. And she developed an effective protocol for treating PTSD and trauma-related problems using this bilateral stimulation or this back and forth eye movements, and published the first research study on this approach in 1989. So hence the name eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing. And it's a memory-focused psychotherapy that helps people deal with the impact and legacy of trauma. And it's based on the idea that psychological problems are related to a failure to adequately process traumatic experiences or memories, right? So if you were a fly on the wall, early sessions involve taking a thorough history and coming up with a treatment plan, establishing safety and trust within the therapeutic relationship, and resourcing, skill building work if needed to make sure that a client is ready to approach challenging emotional material. Now, most people don't show up saying, I want to work on my traumatic memories from age 5 or age 12. Most walk through our doors and they say, I'm miserable, I'm having trouble coping, my marriage is falling apart, I'm depressed or anxious. And we often begin with the client's current distress and we float back looking for the root of the distress. We search for relevant memories to target. Once a target memory is identified, we activate the memory through a series of questions. And then we introduce 30 to 60 second sets of eye movements or bilateral back and forth stimulation to jumpstart and support the brain's stalled information processing system. Now, over the years, we've discovered that other forms of what we call bilateral stimulation are also effective in reducing distress. So we might have clients track our fingers back and forth. We might have them track a light that moves back and forth, or we might have them listen to headphones alternating tones, beep, 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 or we might tap back and forth on their hands as they rest their hands in their lap. And by the way, during the pandemic, we discovered to great delight that EMDR can be done virtually. It's quite effective when done virtually. But with every set of bilateral stimulation, the client is asked to simply notice what changes or emerges and to report. What are the images, the thoughts, the feelings, the sensations, the impulses, the insights that are emerging? We encourage them to just notice, to be a passenger on a train, just watching the scenery go by. And we remind them to always stay connected to the present moment, just witnessing from a distance. This is not about reliving. This is about reprocessing. And we remind clients over and over, it's old stuff, just notice, just let it go by. And we stress the importance of what we call dual attention, right? Keeping one foot in the present at all times while accessing the past. And after every set of bilateral stimulation, we ask, what do you get now? What do you notice? What's changing? And as I said, no two people process in the same way. There's no supposed tos or shoulds. We say to clients, whatever comes up, just let it come. And clients remember and they process. They process fear, grief, anger, guilt, and shame. We work to keep the processing body focused by asking questions like, well, where do you feel that? Just notice, it's just a memory. And in the course of processing, a client might imagine saying or doing what they never got to previously say or do, expressing their rage, running away, fighting back with superhuman strength. A client might also spontaneously see their younger self and offer compassion or care in their mind's eye. And with reprocessing, a client's distress eventually decreases and relevant adaptive bits of information located in other parts of the brain, helpful present-day perspectives get integrated. It's over. I'm safe now. I was only a kid doing the best I could. It wasn't actually my fault. And there are shifts. There's radical shifts in thoughts, feelings, behaviors, physical sensations. Healing involves spontaneous movement toward more positive thinking and more manageable feelings, and a significant reduction in the level of disturbance experienced in one's body. And final thing I'll say is that comprehensive treatment addresses past traumatic events, current triggers of and symptoms, and future behavioral goals. So we're not only working to put those old experiences on the shelf, put the past in the past, but we're neutralizing the triggers in the present, and we're helping people to face the things that they haven't been able to face in the present and set new goals for themselves moving forward.
How do these different traumas affect the brain, and how would we manifest some of the after effects? How do we know we're suffering the after effects?
Yeah. You know, when someone is exposed to traumatic circumstances, their memories get locked or frozen in the nervous system, in our brains, right? And what that means when I say a memory gets locked or frozen, that means the images, the feelings, the sensations, the thoughts associated with that original traumatic experience get locked in the nervous system. There's somehow a breakdown in the brain's information processing system. The system is unable to digest the experience, and other information held elsewhere in memory just doesn't get connected in. It doesn't get integrated to help a person make sense of the event. And then days later, weeks later, years later, sometimes when you get triggered, when you get exposed to a situation that somehow reminds you consciously or unconsciously of the original adverse experience, the past suddenly becomes the present. People lose their adult present day grounding and perspective. If all of the components of that frozen memory get triggered, it may look like PTSD, right? Flashbacks, nightmares, intrusive images, fear of situations, hypervigilance. If just the emotional component of the memory gets triggered, sadness, fear, anger, it may look like depression or anxiety or a phobia or road rage. If sensations get triggered, a racing heart or pain in the stomach or nausea, you might think that you need to see a medical doctor rather than a trauma-informed therapist.
Wow. It's quite remarkable. I'm sure lots of people probably have got physical symptoms in their body, ailments, if you wish, and that maybe have never linked them to possibly a suppressed problem deep in their past. And so I think obviously the end game of this therapy is that you walk away in some manner healed, correct?
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. I always tell people that they can get better and they will get better, that I have all the confidence in the world that we can do our work together and they will heal. And I say to people that my job is to make sure that they no longer need therapy, right, and that they can go on with life feeling like they are at their best, right? The goal is to help people move from surviving to thriving.
Okay. We got two pretty personal questions here. Given the potential risk of trauma due to ignoring and emotional neglect in childhood, how might the culture of boarding school impact children?
Interesting. Well, you know, I think simply sending a child off to boarding school is not problematic as long as it's not out of sight, out of mind, as long as they're not neglected, right? I mean, My son is away in the UK this year for college, but I'm present. He is in my heart, in my mind. I'm in touch with him regularly. I want to know how he's doing. If he is facing something that is challenging to him, he knows that he can reach out and we'll process it together and that I'm there. And I will get on a plane at the, you know, in a split second and be in London to be with him if need be. And that's the piece that matters, that there is an attachment that feels secure, that the child or the adolescent going off to boarding school somehow is able to carry that sense of connection and knowing that they exist in the heart and the mind of their parent or their caregiver, no matter where they are, no matter how far away they are, or no matter how long that is.
Okay. Someone else has asked, what if you have no conscious memories of the abuse, but only the symptoms, e.g. disassociation during sexual intimacy? I was able through psychodrama therapy to claim sexual freedom, but I still suffer from anxiety, feelings of dread, often waking at night with such feelings for no apparent reason. There are other ACEs that I have suffered, such as family alcoholism. So would this person hopefully be a good candidate to try another form of therapy like EMDR?
Yes, absolutely. And I think Michael is a good case in point because Michael came into treatment and he was not aware of all of the traumas that occurred in his life. Some he absolutely did not remember. And the work began with his symptoms. Right? The EMDR targeted his current distress. He floated back from his current distress and paying attention to the body, paying attention to the beliefs, paying attention to the emotions that were activated in the present, he was able to access those earlier experiences. And even if experiences are pre-verbal and there's no explicit memory of those events, often you're able to access a felt sense, a feeling in the body that can be targeted with EMDR. And perhaps you won't ever actually remember everything about what happened, but you can get relief and you can process it through the body, through an affective connection to it.
One person's asking whether it can help with chronic sleep difficulty. And the other one says, how does one know whether the actual memories elicited in EMDR are events that actually happened? This is the fake memory question, of course.
Right. So sleep. Sleep is a complicated phenomenon. My husband is a cognitive neuroscientist and a sleep researcher. So we talk about sleep a lot in our household. Very, very often, though, as people go through EMDR therapy, they find that the quality of their sleep improves. They find that, you know, certainly if they're having nightmares, if they're having sleep disturbances, that subsides. You know, that's what occurred for Michael. His nightmares he had his entire life ceased and the quality of his sleep improved. You know, as your nervous system calms down, right? As we neutralize those unprocessed memories in the nervous system, your whole system starts to settle. As Michael was saying, his old operating system got switched out and he had a new operating system that was calmer, more relaxed, more grounded. So all of that can have an impact on better sleep. The second question was, how do we know, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we can't know. We can't know. And I always say to folks that EMDR is not a truth serum, right? It's not like a lie detector. It's not, right? We're going to work with what emerges. And together with my clients, we look at what emerges and we work with it. I don't weigh in on whether this is what happened or this is exactly what happened or not. I can't possibly know that, but we work with what emerges and we're interested in results. We're interested in relief. And if processing what emerges brings relief, if it makes meaning out of symptoms, if it allows people to connect the dots and develop a site map that helps them have a framework for understanding many things in their lives, then we're moving in the right direction.
What are the main protective factors against illness post-trauma? And then somebody says, is it possible to proactively use these techniques to lessen the impact of trauma?
You may stump me with the last one just as we're closing, but protective factors after a trauma. Well, I think the most important things are the basics. When you have been through a traumatic experience, you want to make sure that your basic needs are being met right after the trauma. So after school shootings, after, you know, violence in our society, making sure that people are able to feel safe again, that they understand what's happening in their bodies. They understand, you know, what the effects of trauma are. So education about what's happening, that they're able to eat and sleep and be cared for first and foremost. But then also having an opportunity to process right after that experience, talk it through, write about it, you know, explain to people what they experienced, right? With someone safe, someone responsive, someone who is willing to listen and validate. Those are critical factors right after. We do EMDR right after critical incidents. We get right in there after a critical incident and work with people. We've got lots of protocols to do that. The last question was
using these techniques to less proactively using them, which
proactively. Yeah. I would say the proactive aspect of EMDR is that EMDR is a comprehensive treatment. So we work on past events, we work on present triggers, and we help people prepare for the future. So in helping them to prepare for the future, in helping them play movies of stepping into future challenging situations or even traumatic situations, carrying new beliefs, a new sense of self, and seeing themselves coping effectively, we're preparing people to be more resilient in the future.
Very, very important. This last question, there's kind of a micro application to this work, and of course, there's a macro application. And I'm quoting you now, you said EMDR helps individuals get better and it serves the greater good. I see my work as a form of social action, a way to contribute to ending cycles of violence in the world. So my question is EMDR being used in schools or prisons where it could really make a difference?
Yeah. So yes, EMDR is being used in schools and in prisons. We're addressing the effects of racial trauma in marginalized communities. We're using EMDR in women's shelters and rape crisis centers. We're training therapists in third world countries and war-torn societies. Right this very second, in fact, there is a team in the Ukraine teaching Ukrainian therapists to do EMDR therapy with their traumatized communities.
Wow. So what would be the best website, Debbie, if someone was going to go to one website to find out more about this?
Well, I would encourage them to go to our website, which is Every Memory Deserves Respect, all one word, everymemorydeservesrespect.com, the name of our book. But I also think that they can go to the EMDR Institute website. That's the institute that I'm a part of, which is just emdr.com.
Great. That's for people that might want to try and find therapists.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay. Well, I would really like to thank both of our really remarkable guests, Dr. Debbie Korn and Michael Baldwin, who offers us all hope, help, and resources. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, Mass Cultural Council, the Cambridge Community Foundation, and of course you. So if you want to donate or sign up to our list, please visit the website, cambridgeforum.org. Thank you all for joining us, and I hope to see you all soon.